AgBio Science is supported by Indiana Farm Bureau.
Organizations need to recognize that 100% like true capital efficiency is actually a really dangerous proposition. You have to allow some deliberate inefficiency into the organization to continue to learn and to be able to build resilience over time.
Welcome to AgBio Science, the number one podcast in the world for innovation in food, animal health, plant science, ag tech, and agriculture. Here is your host, Agrinovis CEO, Mitch Fraser.
Welcome back to Ag Bioscience. We are living in a time of innovation crisis, one where most of the innovation isn't driven by large corporations, despite those corporations being managed better than ever before. That's the view of today's guest, who is out with a new book tomorrow entitled The Illusion of Innovation. Welcome back, longtime innovator, friend, now author, Elliot Parker. Elliot, welcome Mitch. Back to Ag Bioscience.
Good to be here.
I am so excited. Right here in front of me, you can hear the pages turn, is your new book, The Illusion of Innovation, out tomorrow. I think this is the first time since college, Elliot, and that's been a couple days ago, where I have flags, I have scribbles, I have stuff highlighted. This book is absolutely incredible.
That's amazing. Thank you.
It is so good. We have so much to cover. And as we think about the application of ag bioscience, this is universally applicable to any corporation. I think it's important we start with where you started, at least early on in your career, with the late Clayton Christensen, author of the revolutionary book, Innovator's Dilemma. It is something that I think has shaped both of our careers, both of our beliefs. You worked in corporate innovation. Now you're working with corporations all around the globe to ignite innovation. Before we jump into the book, we have to sort of understand how your background led you to the belief that the illusion of innovation is a reality.
I'll go back almost 30 years ago. Clayton Christensen wrote a book called The Innovator's Dilemma. Clay was a professor at the Harvard Business School, or about to become a professor at the Harvard Business School. This is actually his doctoral thesis at the time. What he realized is that executives in organizations can do everything right, everything that they're taught to do, and their companies will ultimately fail. And it turns out this is a really hard problem to solve. The reason why companies fail is that executives focus on serving their best customers, increasing profitability, running their companies more efficiently. And as they move up market to serve these best customers, they leave themselves exposed at the low end to new disruptors who come in, grab a foothold, who then move up market themselves and displace these incumbents. So executives do everything right. Let's increase profitability. Let's serve our best customers. You're on a path to failure, it turns out. And so how do you fix that? We've been trying to figure that out for 30 years. And it turns out it's a much harder problem than anybody anticipated when Clay wrote his original thesis.
I look at this. I'm going to flip to one of my flags here in the book. And you talk about some of the work that you were in your career where you were in an innovation team and you're looking back on this. And I love this. At a certain point, our team felt like animals in a petting zoo brought out for show, but with limited ability to really do what we knew needed to be done. You're talking about innovation, this conflict between efficiency, resiliency, of not just creating innovation theater, but actually creating innovation. How do companies overcome that?
The problem really became evident to me during the COVID crisis, actually, when we saw a lot of companies dealing with supply chain problems and failing. I think everybody generally has a sense. Most people have a sense that our large institutions, government, schools, businesses, somehow seem less capable than they once were. We look back 80, 100 years ago and we hear stories about what these large organizations were able to accomplish. And then we see our institutions today failing in the face of challenge and opportunity, and we wonder what has changed. I decided to write this book because I felt like something had changed, and it's important to understand what that is, why things are different now, and what we do about it. But during big crises like COVID, you see these organizations that are so optimized for efficiency, that have these global supply chains that operate so incredibly efficiently. They're amazing. They're amazing inventions.
Right.
Talk about in the book, we think about the great pyramids in Egypt as nothing that pales in comparison to the modern supply chain of a global Fortune 500 company. It's this decades and decades of people figuring out, optimizing, tinkering, making things better. Well, it turns out that renders companies incredibly fragile and brittle, because when one piece of that super optimized system breaks, the whole thing crashes. And it turns out it's not very resilient. Organizations need to recognize that 100%, like, true capital efficiency is actually a really dangerous proposition. You have to allow some deliberate inefficiency into the organization to continue to learn and to be able to build resilience over time.
As I read through the book, the first couple chapters, the first three or four chapters, I struggled really internalizing that thought of, you have to be okay with inefficiency. Everything we've been taught in school, everything we've been taught in business school is the exact opposite of that. You have to get to efficiency. You have to deliver IRR. Your perspective, as you outline in the book, you walk through why that's dangerous. You just did. And then add that to what Clay said. One of the worst places to actually start a new business is within a business, right? The incentives aren't aligned. Do you still believe that incentive disalignment is actually the core of what creates a challenge for innovation?
Yeah, efficiency isn't bad. It's a good thing. If you look around the world, most of the innovations that we enjoy are examples of what you might call sustaining innovation or improvements in efficiency in organizations. Those are fantastic. What I'm arguing is that you don't achieve long-term growth through sustaining or efficiency innovation alone. You have to allow some form, some messiness, some chaos into the organization on purpose to be able to access the breakthroughs, to uncover the anomalies that lead you to challenge the assumptions that the organizations previously believed to be true. Think about these large organizations as they scale and focus on efficiency. They build systems of governance, of talent, of incentive systems and processes that are optimized to run things across the world with extreme efficiency. And then they realize we need to innovate and do things that are different. Well, innovation by its nature is a capital inefficient process. It requires making mistakes. It requires learning along the way. And when you try and take that system that is optimized for scaled execution and apply it to a fundamentally different activity, learning, we shouldn't be surprised when it doesn't work. Yet consistently, I see in large organizations surprise and disappointment when it fails to realize the outcomes that people hope to achieve.
One of my favorite parallels you make in the book is to the forest and the need for controlled burns. I was shocked. In fact, I was in California earlier this week talking with folks. Clearly, I was talking about The Illusion of Innovation by one Elliot Parker. And they played back to me something around controlled burns and the inability of governments to manage forest fires. In the book, you say decades of avoidance of small fires is evidenced by a relentless focus on capital efficiency, renders institutions extremely fragile in the face of inevitable shocks. When the fire comes, it quickly burns with intensity. You got to walk through this. I mean, this, Elliot, is one of the most beautiful illustrations of a focus on efficiency and an avoidance of risk that has led to catastrophe.
Thank you. Yeah, my great-grandparents are buried in a town called Paradise, California. So some personal connection to the fires that have swept through parts of California, including Paradise, famously, a few years ago. If you look back, people have looked at tree rings in forests in the West and have looked at the prevalence and intensity of forest fires over time. And what they've found is that when people started settling those areas in great numbers, we got really good at reducing both the intensity and prevalence of fires. In other words, we got really good when a fire pops up, we are experts at putting those fires out. And that is a remarkable human achievement that saved lives and property. And on one hand, a very good thing. On the other hand, when you look at the numbers, back in the time of the gold rush in California, 4.5 million acres of forest burned every year naturally. By the 1950s, 1960s, we had gotten so good at putting out fires that only 250,000 acres a year burned. And as a result, forests become more and more dense with tinder. And so that when fires do come, they burn with incredible intensity and are hard to prevent. We've seen in the last decade, most of the largest fires in the history of the U.S. have happened in the Western United States because of that problem. Now, everybody knows what to do about it. The solution, as you mentioned, is controlled burns. You map out the area like a checkerboard and you go through and selectively, strategically burn on purpose certain areas to reduce the
fuel that would otherwise go in a big fire. The problem is that the incentives don't encourage anyone to do that. So we can stand and we can look and say, we need to operate and run controlled burns. In fact, some have argued that the fire debt in the state of California, the amount of land that would need to burn to get back to a normal state is the equivalent size in terms of acreage to the state of Maine. It's a massive fire debt. And I think in the last few years, the state of California has done controlled burns of 15 to 20,000 acres a year. It's nothing. It might as well be nothing. It's embarrassing. The problem is one of incentives. The governor can sign documents. People can agree this is what we need to do. But for that individual land manager who has to go execute the burn, the risks are too high of that burn going out of control. The potential for a fire to occur on their land while they are employed there is very low. There's no upside. And the same thing happens inside our organizations. Those who are running large corporations face a similar problem. The incentives are such that we're focused on making things efficient, at putting out those small fires, at making things predictable and safe, which on the one hand is good. On the other hand, when crisis comes, it is much more fierce and intense than it used to be. And it leads to companies' failure. We see this in the life cycle of companies. The lifespan of Fortune 500 companies, those lifespans are dramatically shrinking because of this problem. It's much harder for large companies to compete because we have gotten so good at managing our companies for efficiency.
So how do we take from efficiency to resiliency? We'll jump into it right after this. Ag Bioscience is supported by Indiana Farm Bureau.
From berries to dairies, from crop advisors to data analyzers, Indiana Farm Bureau is at the forefront of the top issues impacting Indiana agriculture. No matter your role in the ag industry, Indiana Farm Bureau membership means you'll always have a champion and an advisor. And because so much of your time is focused on your own enterprise, it's also good to know Indiana Farm Bureau is always working to fight for the future of agriculture. We come together to advocate for rural viability, the protection of property rights, competitive tax policies, and against burdensome regulations. Whether our members need a door opened, an impact in public policy, or an ally to strengthen their communities, Indiana Farm Bureau is there. We are the unified voice for all agriculture. To learn more about the benefits of Indiana Farm Bureau membership, go to infb.org.
Welcome back to Ag Bioscience. We're talking with author and friend, Elliot Parker. Elliot, you just walked through this idea of controlled burns and the criticality of managing not just for risk, but actually managing creating resiliency. I want to dig into how that happens. Specifically, you talk about experimentation in the book and these small experiments at scale, doing a lot, getting in a lot of reps. I love this. You just describe them as rapid, organic, and cheap. Later on in the book, you call them weird, which makes me so excited. I can't wait to hear more about that. But as you look at these, this isn't just about, and we've heard this, particularly in venture capital. Well, it's pattern matching, right? We've seen this cycle before, so we'll match a pattern. You argue the exact opposite. It's not about pattern matching. It's actually about learning. Talk more about that.
In the end, you look at companies that are most successful, and you can measure success in a lot of ways. For me, an important metric in success is just the sheer endurance of organizations. We've done a lot of research into these companies that were founded over 1,000 years ago, have endured a very long time. The oldest company in the world was founded 100 years after the fall of the Roman Empire. Wow. Just in the last 25 years was acquired and became a subsidiary. It's no longer operating independently, but we can look at those types of companies and we can learn a lot. One thing that they all have in common, companies that endure and are extremely successful are extraordinary at experimentation. They take a systematic approach to experimentation in the service of customer needs. They run those experiments inexpensively, quickly, and often those experiments are weird. And what I mean by that is those experiments are designed to uncover anomalies, surprises. They're not designed to reinforce what we already know. They're designed to help us uncover things that challenge what we know. Organizations that can do that well are the ones that endure and win. And you see that across the board. Once you recognize it, it becomes something so obvious you've got to act on it. The issue is, it's a structural problem. A lot of executives and companies say, well, we've got a smart team. We've got all the will. We know how to run these experiments. We see the problems. We can build the solutions. It doesn't matter how smart your team is, how strong their will is. if these ideas are fundamentally different from the business you operate today, the organization will not allow them to succeed. It's a structural problem and it requires a structural solution. Meaning for those ideas, those opportunities that are far from your core business today, you have to pursue innovation outside your existing core business. It's the only way.
You talk in the book about the difference in that, the structural difference in that. This is a balance sheet exercise, not an income statement exercise.
Yeah.
Talk more about that.
Yeah. This is a very, very much an underappreciated accelerant or hurdle to innovation.
Sure.
It's the funding mechanism. Most organizations, when we think about innovating, the funding mechanism is an afterthought. We come up with a problem, let's build a solution. And at the end, we think, okay, how much is it going to cost? How do we fund it? The reality is that the funding mechanism determines how far we can go.
How long the horizon is.
The horizon is. When we're funding innovation as an operating activity, that means that that innovation is going to have to compete with things where the ROI is known ahead of time. And in the end, certain ROI things like marketing or other activities where we know what the return is going to be, those things are going to win because that's how the organization retains efficiency. So what you have to do is find new funding mechanisms. And in our view, balance sheet capital, the same funding mechanisms that are used to do acquisitions or big long-term investments can be used to fund innovation. The trick is to take that innovation and spin it out, put it into external ventures that that balance sheet capital can be deployed into. Now, innovation can be funded as a long-term investment activity rather than an operating activity.
You talk about this in the book specifically. In aggregate, corporations have more liquid assets on their balance sheet than ever, $6.5 trillion as of early 23, more than double the amount of 10 years earlier.
And what's amazing is that we see organizations using that capital to do things like share buybacks, which in some ways is just a sign. It's raising the flag. We don't know how to innovate. Sometimes there are good reasons to do share buybacks, but often at the scale that we see, it's a signal that large corporations have lost their ability to dream big dreams.
And those big dreams, I found this so exhilarating because we talk about big dreams. We talk about what problem are you trying to solve? Are you uniquely positioned to solve it? Sort of all the base level questions. But you make a call out here to anticipate and solve future problems and worry less about current ones. Develop a hypothesis about the future and make it happen.
Yeah.
I mean, this idea of not being caught up in today's problem, which is very much an income statement exercise, right?
Yep.
But how do we think about the problem that is 5 years, 10 years, 20 years in advance? What framework have you found to be helpful to sort of suspend reality of the day to look toward the future?
Couple of things. Think about in the world of venture capital where I operate, you don't win by going along with the crowd. You think about if we could draw it a 2x2 on the whiteboard. On one axis, you've got you're going along with the consensus or you're contrarian. On the other axis, you're right or you're wrong. Well, you go along with the consensus and you're right. Guess what? That doesn't win you any awards. In fact, in if you're running a scaled business and you're right and you go along with the consensus, you're going to go out of business. The only way you win over the long term is by being contrarian or being anti-consensus and turning out to be right. So the trick is you've got to find ways to find those insights that help you uncover the ways you can go against the consensus and be right. You've got to run more experiments to uncover those insights. And the way to focus what you need to do is think about your customers. We talked about experimentation and the service of customer needs. We use a framework called Jobs to be Done that was famously developed by Clayton Christensen. I have not seen anything change companies more than that framework. Jobs to be Done is the idea that we don't buy products. We hire them to do a job for us. And when you understand that, it sounds like a small twist, but when you understand what job customers are hiring your business to do or your products to do, it opens up new vistas for innovation. If you think about, I may hire the watch I'm wearing right now can solve multiple jobs to be done. It might tell me the time. It might signal something socially. It might represent a gift that a family member gave me. It's the same product. But when we think about innovation, we might innovate along how do you tell time better? How do you make this a better gift? Things like that. Jobs to be done can open up new vistas for innovation. Now, here's the thing. Our jobs to be done as customers don't change. They are eternal. They stay. They remain. But the prioritization changes as technology changes, as our circumstances change, the ways that we might address those problems. So the important thing for companies to understand is to have a deep connection to those jobs to be done that they're addressing for their customers. focus on innovating around those jobs to be done, rather than focus, many companies do, is focus on innovating around the product that we sell as it exists today.
Solution in search of a problem, not a problem in search of a solution.
Yeah, or incremental improvements, right?
Right.
We do this thing, maybe we could offer it in different colors or 10% faster, 20% cheaper. That is great. And there's a place for that. You should continue doing that. What I'm arguing is that that's not a path to long-term growth and sustainability. You need to find new solutions.
There is a great unlock here. And I think there's this conflict that likely exists in organizations. We've both seen it in many, where we have to go innovate or we have to keep the lights on. This is not a or proposition.
Yeah.
It has to be an and proposition. And there's always going to be folks on the sidelines saying you can't. And one of my favorite lines in the book, I'm a fairly optimistic fella. You talk about optimists winning, which made me really happy. But Ellie, this is so powerful. Pessimists sound smart, but optimists make money.
Yep.
And they shape the future. As we wrap this up, what's the call to action? How do you channel that optimism? And how do you take experimentation to the next level within an organization?
Yeah, I believe optimism is a moral duty. That is a famous quote from Edwin Land, who founded Polaroid, used to say that all the time. Optimism is a moral duty. I believe it's right. We have a responsibility to be good ancestors for those who are yet to come. And you think about it that way, it helps us think in longer timelines and to be optimistic about the future. If you look over the course of time, the optimists on average have been much more correct than the pessimists. And there's no reason to believe that that won't change. That doesn't mean there aren't going to be hard things ahead of us. There will be lots of problems. Being an optimist means that we believe that our capacity to address those problems will increase. So really important that we all be optimistic and recognize that we're in the face of big challenges yet to come. We're going to get better and better at addressing those. And that hopefully that this book is an attempt to lay out some ways that people might do that.
Well, this book has lots of reasons to, you have a lot of reason to be optimistic. I have a lot of reasons to be optimistic because I think this will fundamentally change the way that companies innovate. I am elated to have read it, elated to call you a friend. You can find this book, pre-order today. It comes out tomorrow, April 16th, 2024. The Illusion of Innovation by Elliot Parker. Elliot, it's just been a delight to spend time with you.
Great. Thanks, Mitch. Same.
And thanks so much for tuning into Ag Bioscience. On behalf of the entire Agronovus team, I'm Mitch Frazier, saying thanks for listening. We look forward to seeing you real soon.
Ag Bioscience is a podcast by Agronovus Indiana, hosted by Mitch Frazier, produced by Kayla Chittister and Fabian Rodriguez, photography and design by Kaylee Kerr. If you liked today's episode, subscribe, rate, and review so we can bring you more conversations just like this. Get all episodes of Ag Bioscience at agronovusindiana.com.